Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello again from Washington. We come to you every day with interesting stories from around the world, and we tell these stories in a way that makes them easy to understand if English is not your first language. Today we will talk about groups of people who move away from their country, or diasporas, and then send money back home. There is a growing trend to use the power of this money, called diaspora finance, to boost the economies in the developing world. Mary Gottschall explains.
Luis Lopez Ramirez, a 30-year-old Honduran immigrant, makes pizza. He has worked two jobs over 16 hours each day. He carefully saves his money and rents a small room in Washington, D.C. He sends money back to Honduras to pay for the education of his two sons, whom he talks to every week by phone. He says he hopes to bring them to the U.S. to live with him one day. The money he sends home also bought a small house in the village of Santa Barbara, Honduras. He will return someday, he says, and start a business. But he left Honduras because the economy is terrible and wages are very low. One pizza with all the toppings is the same price as 1 or 2 weeks of pay in Honduras, says Lopez Ramirez. The money he sends back to Honduras is an example of remittances. Remittances help build the economies of poor countries, and it can lessen the burden on government aid programs. Experts say that these remittances, or diaspora finance, can fuel growth and create jobs in the developing world. Diasporas have not only powered the development of the United States, but also hold the potential for transforming countries around the world, reports the U.S. Agency for International Development. That money has a huge impact on global economics. The diaspora sends 16 times more than official U.S. development assistance, or $581 billion in remittances around the world every year. If the global diaspora were its own country, it would be the world's fourth largest nation, according to USAID. There are about 230 million people who live outside their country of origin, including legal as well as illegal immigrants. Here's an example of how diaspora finance works on the local level. Isis Salmeron, a 26-year-old Salvadorian immigrant in Maryland, has lived in America for 6 years. She worked with the Latino Economic Development Center to raise $11,000 from the local Salvadorian community and other local residents. Last month, she and a group of nonprofit leaders and Salvadorian immigrants in Maryland traveled back to El Salvador and donated the money to a hospital in Morazan, El Salvador's poorest region. One-third of the population is foreign-born where Salmeron lives, outside of Washington, D.C. Salvadorians represent the largest group of those immigrants, according to Maryland's Department of Legislative Services. The U.S. State Department is promoting diaspora finance for international development. We've gone from an era where power lived almost exclusively in old establishment hierarchies to an era where power lives in networks, says Secretary of State John Kerry. The World Bank also supports diaspora finance. Mahmoud Mohyeldin is the president's special envoy at the World Bank in Washington, D.C. Dilip Ratha is head of the World Bank Migration and Remittances Unit. They wrote that the remittances and savings of the diaspora are an underexploited resource. It could play an important role in global development, they wrote. Throughout history, people have sought opportunity in other countries, and they send money to family and friends back home. Those who receive the remittances spend one-third on savings and investment, such as education, buying land, or starting a new business. The remainder is spent on basic daily needs. The challenge is to channel this income effectively, the authors say. They wrote that remittances tend to be larger in poor and small economies and often provide the main lifeline in fragile or conflict-affected countries. Diaspora funds can pay for healthcare, housing, and businesses. Remittances have reduced poverty in countries like Ghana, Bangladesh, and Nepal. They are a major source of funding in many African countries, according to the International Monetary Fund. African migrants send at least $40 billion in remittances to African nations every year. Mohyeldin and Ratha advocate the use of diaspora bonds to promote international development. The bonds could be in small amounts, such as $1,000, and carry interest rates of 3% to 4%. To succeed, diaspora bonds must be linked to development in places where there is sufficient trust in government, writes the World Bank authors. They should also be available to all investors, not just migrant savers, and be distributed widely. That would enable large sums to be used for development at low, stable interest rates, they write. Some developing countries are already using diaspora bonds. Ethiopia, Kenya, Nigeria, Rwanda, and Zimbabwe have issued bonds to their diasporas, according to the IMF. Costs prevent remittances from reaching their full potential. Kanayo Nwanze is president of the United Nations Fund for Agricultural Development. He writes that the average cost of sending money home has come down to below 8% from 15% over the last 5 years. But in parts of Africa, costs can be above 12%. Reducing these costs to 3% would put more than $20 billion annually in the pockets of migrants and their relatives, according to Nwanze. India has been a leader in the use of diaspora bonds. The Indian Diaspora Investment Initiative, launched in February this year, seeks to harness the funds of more than 2 million people in the Indian diaspora in the United States, reported DevEx. DevEx is a media platform for the global development community. The Indian Diaspora Investment Initiative is a partnership between USAID and the Calvert Foundation, part of an investment firm in Maryland. Investors can purchase investment notes sold in amounts as small as $20. Anyone can purchase the notes, although they are marketed to the Indian diaspora community. The notes will raise up to $10 million this year. The funds will be used to buy debt from Indian financial institutions, which will then lend to businesses in socially beneficial sectors like health, food security, and education. Manpreet Anand is USAID's Deputy Assistant Administrator in the Asia Bureau. He tells DevEx that the Indian Initiative is the first project of its kind and represents a new model of development in the agency. If the Indian model is successful, he says, this can pave the way and be a model that is utilized in other countries around the world. I'm Mary Gottschall.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Economics Report. The United States Central Bank has raised an important interest rate by 1/4 of 1%. The move may have been small, but it marks the first time since late 2008 that the Federal Reserve has raised important interest rates that it controls. The federal funds rate, a rate paid by banks for short-term loans, is now 1/2 of 1%. The Federal Reserve Open Market Committee decides monetary policy. The committee announced the change Wednesday in a statement on economic policy. It had met for 2 days in Washington. Janet Yellen, the first woman to lead the Federal Reserve System, spoke after the announcement. The committee's decision was based on a few factors, Yellen said. Economic growth is expected to continue in the U.S. Another reason to increase interest rates, Yellen noted, was the low official rate of inflation. The central bank has said its target inflation rate is 2%. It says that rate would help support employment and keep prices stable. However, inflation currently is not at the target rate, but below 1%. The high exchange value of the dollar has also kept inflation low, Yellen said. The strong dollar means the prices of imported products remain low. The Federal Reserve chief also said the strong labor market provided another reason to raise rates. The U.S. economy is adding about 200,000 jobs each month. Yellen described the path to higher interest rates as normalization. The central bank's interest rates are well below historical averages. The Federal Reserve, or Fed, also released its expectation for some important economic numbers. The Fed expects its federal funds rate to reach between 2% and 4% by 2018. Yellen was asked if the Fed may have moved too soon in increasing interest rates. She answered that the central bank had weighed many risks and had made a small move. She said the Fed's decision today reflects our confidence in the U.S. economy. The central bank has kept the interest rates it controls at nearly zero to support lending and economic activity. Financial policymakers considered this necessary as the country recovered from the Great Recession from 2007 to 2009. During that period, home prices dropped sharply and unemployment jumped in the worst financial crisis since the 1930s. And that's the Economics Report. Keep listening for the American History Program, The Making of a Nation. I'm Mario Ritter.
Well, Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. America's 18th president, Ulysses Grant, was elected to his second term in 1872. Grant had led the Union Army of the North to victory over the Confederate Army of the South during the Civil War. He easily won the presidency in 1868 in the first election held after the war. Now he would spend four more years as President of the United States. This week in our series, Harry Monroe and Kay Gallant tell about Grant's second term in office.
Grant's first administration was marked by dishonesty and shameful events. The situation grew much worse after he won a second term. Grant himself was not involved directly, but his administration suffered because of his ties to those who were involved. Soon after Grant's re-election, for example, there was a serious incident that involved many of his supporters in Congress. The Union Pacific Railroad Company had helped build a railroad across the American West to California. The cost of building the railroad was very high. The company got large amounts of aid from the government. Not all this aid came honestly. An investigation showed that leading members of Congress and even the vice president received shares of ownership in the company for free or at low cost. In exchange, they voted to use federal money to help build the railroad.
A few months later, members of Congress voted a pay raise for themselves and the executive branch of government. The pay raise would be retroactive. This meant the extra money would be paid for the 2 years already passed. Newspapers and citizens raised a storm of protest. Some lawmakers were afraid they would not be reelected, so they refused to accept the pay raise. Within 6 months, another shameful incident was uncovered. This one involved Jay Cook, one of the richest bankers in the country. He also was a good friend of President Grant. In 1869, Cook began raising money to build another railroad across America's West. He planned to sell $100 million worth of railroad bonds. Many people invested all the money they had in Cook's railroad, but Cook was unable to sell as many bonds as he expected. Soon, his banks had no money left. They could return no money to the thousands of people who had bought railroad bonds.
People hurried to other banks to withdraw their savings. Within hours, many of these other banks had to close. They, too, were out of money. Within a month, more than 5,000 banks across the country failed and closed their doors. This created an economic crisis. The New York Stock Exchange closed for 10 days. Factories closed. Thousands of people lost their jobs. Investigations showed that many of the banks that failed had violated banking laws. The laws often were not enforced because so many bankers had given money to the ruling Republican Party.
Other incidents followed. One of the biggest was called the Whiskey Ring. It involved a group of whiskey producers and some high officials who were friends of President Grant. Together, they found a way not to pay taxes on their whiskey. One of Grant's close advisors was at the center of the incident. A grand jury found him not guilty of any crime. However, it charged several hundred whiskey producers and government officials with illegal activities. President Grant had done nothing illegal, but the Whiskey Ring incident increased public feeling that there was no honesty in the White House. The feeling grew that Grant was a failure.
These incidents took place during a time of intense social and political change in the United States. The period after the Civil War was a time of industrial revolution and business growth. Most of this growth was taking place in the North. Before the Civil War, most businesses were small. Now, there were many companies with large numbers of workers. The companies also had large numbers of owners. They sold shares of ownership to anyone with enough money to buy.
A few men rose to positions of great power in business. In the steel industry, for example, there was Andrew Carnegie. He came to the United States as a boy from Scotland. He took a low-paying job in a factory that produced cotton cloth. He worked hard. In time, he earned enough money to take control of an iron factory. Carnegie soon built another factory. This one produced steel with a new technology. The system worked well. Soon, he was earning more than $1 million a year. He competed fiercely with other steel companies. He pressured railroads to transport his steel for lower prices than his competitors. And he cut his prices to force other steelmakers out of the business. Before long, Andrew Carnegie was the unquestioned leader of America's steel industry. His position gave him great power over the economy of the whole country.
What Carnegie did for the steel industry, John D. Rockefeller did for the oil industry. Oil became a useful product only in the middle of the 1800s. Rockefeller was part of a group of businessmen who built an oil processing center in Ohio. It was so successful that Rockefeller gave up his other business interests. He put all his money into oil production. He formed the Standard Oil Company of Ohio. John D. Rockefeller's new company used the same aggressive business methods as Andrew Carnegie. Rockefeller bought control of other oil processing companies. He started price wars that forced his competitors out of business. Most important, Rockefeller made a secret deal with the railroads. The deal greatly reduced his transportation costs. This permitted him to crush his competition. Before long, he controlled 95% of the oil processing industry in the United States.
As with steel and oil, America's railroads were an extremely important business in the 1800s. In fact, they were the nation's biggest business. They were as important as automobiles and airplanes are to the American economy today. Before the Civil War, most railroads were east of the Mississippi River. Most were small lines. In the years after the war, four major railroads got control of almost all the lines in the east, and they began building new lines in the west.
The first rail line to cross the nation was completed in 1869. It was built by two companies. One company started from the east and went west. The other went in the opposite direction. Finally, after 6 years of back-breaking labor, the two work teams met in northern Utah. They connected the rail lines with a golden spike. It was a great moment in the nation's history. Now, at last, the two coasts of the United States were united by a single line of metal rail. It was like the day 100 years later when the first American walked on the moon.
Like the steel and oil industries, the railroad industry also had its stories of intense business competition. In this case, the most influential man was Cornelius Vanderbilt. Vanderbilt already was rich from the shipping industry. Now, he formed the New York Central Railroad. It was the largest railroad in the East. Cornelius Vanderbilt tried to take over the railroad industry. He was not as successful as Andrew Carnegie with steel, or John D. Rockefeller with oil. A group of other rich railroad owners blocked his plans. But Vanderbilt did succeed in winning a great amount of power and influence.
Vanderbilt and the other new leaders of industry were powerful, and they let others know it. They sometimes made statements about how they did not have to obey the law. Other powerful men thought the same way. Some were officials, elected or appointed to serve in the federal government. Political power blinded them to their responsibility to be honest and fair to the public. As a result, the Republican Party lost public support. The blame was placed on Ulysses Grant. That will be our story next week.
Our program was written by Frank Beardsley. The narrators were Harry Monroe and Kay Gallant. Transcripts, MP3s, and podcasts of our programs can be found, along with historical images, at voaspecialenglish.com. Join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, an American history series in VOA Special English.